afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me once again for a Saturday afternoon with Carolyn Yeager. I'm Carolyn, and the date is September 20th, 2014. I think you will like what I have for you today. The overall theme is the difficulty for any positive advocacy for white people specifically, whether racial or ethnic, to receive a fair hearing in this globalized world in which we now live. And in fact, the outright persecution of white people who try to express this theme or promote these ideas. To start out, I'm going to be joined very shortly by Evelyn Hutchison, who is the mother of Matt Hale, the incarcerated founder of the New Church of the Creator, now called the Creativity Movement. The first Church of the Creator was started by Ben Klassen, based on his book, Nature's Eternal Religion. I will provide links to this in case anyone isn't already familiar with the creativity religion, but this is not going to be discussed on the program. Matt Hale's wrongful imprisonment for something he did not do is, and also the nature of our justice system, both in this North American hemisphere and in Europe. So to start out, Mrs. Hutchison calls in, and if she is by any chance listening, she can call in any time now. I will say that I've been studying up on this situation with Matt Hale. Of course, I've known about him for a long time, and I've known about the creativity religion also for a long time since, maybe before, but I knew a woman. In 2007, I was involved with a woman in a group that I was involved with, I could say. And she was an English woman, and she was using a pseudonym, but she was a lovely, lovely person, and she was writing for a magazine that I was writing for, too, and all associated with this group, and we got to be friends. And she was a minister of creativity, and she was also a pretty committed national socialist. Well, she liked both of them. You know, when you're one, you kind of can go along with the other, unless you're a Christian. Well, she was a creativity minister, and she had about five. She and her husband had five or six children. And she wasn't that old at this time. I mean, she was, you know, middle age, I guess, and maybe in her 40s. And she was doing all these things, you know. She was writing. She was active in British politics. She became very active in British national politics after that. We kept in touch a little bit. And, she was a very admirable person. And what I've been reading about Matt Hale more extensively since yesterday and this morning, I see him as a very admirable person also. He is, I've never heard him speak, but I imagine he is very effective. He's a very effective writer. And this is why I'm going to make the point that this is why he's in prison today. Not because of anything he actually did, but because he is such an effective spokesperson for this cause, this racial cause, which is the bugaboo of the New World Order and cannot be allowed. And so if people are not very effective in discussing it, then they leave him alone. But if they are effective, then they will do something about it. And we're going to talk about the story of how this, what was done and how it happened. And here is the call now, and I'm answering it. Hello there.
Yes.
Hi there.
Are you?
Oh, well, hi, and thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for allowing me.
Well, I'm very pleased to be speaking with you. Since I've gotten kind of turned on to all this, I was telling the audience, since I've been reading your son's writings since yesterday, I'm all turned on to it because he's such an effective spokesperson.
Yes.
And you have You have a great son there.
Yes, I do.
Well,
I'm very proud of him.
Well, good. Can I call you Evelyn?
Yes, sure.
All right. Well, Evelyn, you are a strong advocate for your son, as I just remarked, and well, as I found out from the material you sent to me. When did you start advocating for him?
Well, I always have been. It's just that fairly recent, I began to see how important I better start doing something besides thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you haven't been doing all this work, with press releases
When he started asking me to, I started doing it.
Right. Well, that's the impression I got, that he was doing things in a different way, and maybe just in the last couple of years, he himself decided that, boy, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And then he contacted you, and you've been helping. Okay. Do you have more people? I mean, do you have a good number of helpers, or is it pretty much a small group?
Pretty much me. We have a lot of supporters, of course, but I'm basically doing the work.
Okay. Well, I admire you for that. I'll just, might have something that you wanted to say, you wanted to present, and I've got questions and some things, and a lot of it is about his background from the time he entered Bradley University until he was arrested.
I have information about the case if you want to hear that, or if you want to start by talking about Bradley University and whatever.
Well, I think since people who are listening, the listeners may not be all that familiar with it, I'm sure we have listeners who are even creators. At least I would think so. But for those who aren't, it'd probably be a good idea for you to outline just why your son is in prison and how long he's been there and all of that.
Okay. Matthew was tried and convicted in federal court in Hammond, Indiana in 2004 for having solicited the murder of Chicago federal judge Joan Lefkoe. James T. Moody was the judge in the trial. No evidence was ever presented during trial that Matt ever asked anyone to kill or to murder anybody. Matt is an innocent man that has suffered at the hands of our corrupt government, the corrupt FBI, and our corrupt justice system. The government had Tony Evola, a government informant, which they paid $75,000 to tape conversations with Matt over a two-year period to attempt to get evidence that they could use to put Matt away. On these tapes, never once did Matt ever ask this informant to kill anybody. In fact, Evola was confused as to who the government wanted Matt to ask him to kill. So he thought the target was a man. When the government realized that Evola thought the target was a man, they had him send Matt an email referring to the target as being Femela. And I say that because that's what was on the email. Evola was actually mentally challenged, but they wanted to make sure that he knew that it was a female that they wanted him to get Matt to kill. Okay. Matt was not present during the entire jury selection, even though he never waived that right. He was only present for 48% of the time. The law is that he is to be present for the entire jury selection. When Evola testified in the trial, because nothing on the tapes revealed Matt asking Evola to kill the judge, Evola testified that he asked Matt if he wanted him to kill the judge, and Matt nodded, because there was nothing on the tapes that he had asked him anything like that.
Right.
Matt suspected that Evola was a government informant. He wasn't concerned because he knew he would always follow the law and never do anything illegal. Matt was very naive and believed he was safe from prosecution because he always followed the law. Matt went to law school to become an attorney and to make legal change in the government and our court system. Just recently, Matt discovered that the jury foreman had testified in another unrelated case that he had disobeyed the judge's order not to read anything about Matt or listen to the media. After being accepted as one of the jurors, he went home and did, in fact, follow the media coverage about Matt and the case, disobeying the judge's orders. He had run home and removed a note from his door saying he was going to be on the jury for Matt Hale's trial because he was afraid one of Matt's supporters might harm him or his partner. He is gay, okay? Matt's attorney had a list of over 100 witnesses and never called one to testify. When Matt told him that he wanted to testify, his attorney told him that he wasn't prepared to do that. The judge, James Moody, allowed another man's crime into Matt's trial. It was very obvious that the judge was prejudiced against Matt, as was the prosecutor. They probably had coffee before walking into the courtroom. Matt's attorney, Thomas Durkin of Chicago, told the jury that they should find Matt guilty on moral charges. He told the jury that he didn't like how disgusting Matt was, in so many words. The last statement the prosecutor said to the jury is that the government had evidence that Matthew Hale ordered one of his organization to go out and kill and injure many people. This is totally untrue. There was never any evidence presented at trial that Matt ever asked anyone to kill anybody. Matthew's attorney never objected. The judge never said anything to the jury asking him to disallow that statement. The trial was tainted and prejudiced. The jury foreman was homosexual, feared Matt's supporters. He went into the jury room ready to find Matt guilty before hearing any evidence. There was no evidence. The judge sentenced Matt using the sentencing guidelines used in sentencing a terrorist. Matt is not a terrorist. He gave Matt a 40-year sentence. Matt has been in solitary confinement for 11 years. He is innocent of any crime. And Judge Moody, the prosecutor, and the government knows it. Matt has repeatedly asked for a lie detector test to prove his innocence and has been refused. Recently, he sent David Bindi, the prosecutor that took the place of David Weissman, the prosecutor that prosecuted Matt, a letter asking for a polygraph and was refused. They know it would show that Matt is innocent. We are looking for an attorney in Colorado that does federal appeal work, that also does pro bono work to help Matt. If any of your listeners can help Matt in finding help, please contact me at Evelyn Hutchison, 1938@gmail.com. We're asking for donations for Matt's defense fund and the publishing of his book. My address is Evelyn Hutchison, 200 Carlson Avenue, apartment 25H, Washington, Illinois, 61571. Now we can talk about your question.
Well, that's a very good rundown, and I want to emphasize that from everything I've read, all that you've said is absolutely true, and it's just shocking the way this trial went, because it is true that there was no evidence whatsoever of this crime that he's been convicted of.
I know,
but there's a lot of I guess they presented and brought people forward talking a lot about racialism and other things that went on with Matt in his church or whatever, and kind of confused things and got the jury to I didn't know about that jury foreman being a gay man.
Isn't that something?
Yes, it is. It really is. It makes a big difference when you have a defendant like Matt, so that would be...
And this jury foreman was well aware of what Matt believed in, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was terrified. So when he walked into that juror's room, or jury room, what do you think he had? He had a lot of influence, and that probably... I think he was definitely going to find Matt guilty before he ever walked into that room.
Well, right. I've been on a couple of juries. They've just been, civil cases, but I do realize that jury foremen have a lot of influence and they have a lot of power. So and people want to come to an agreement. So there are always some people who disagree, but then they'll be talked into agreeing just so they can have a verdict. And all of this thing goes on. And also what happens is that the judge instructs jurors in a way that is not right too. And they say, well, all you need to do is find this or this, and they're not supposed to think about it on their own. But the actual law is that jurors don't have to keep within any particular bounds that the judge puts them in, and they can find, they're totally free to find whatever truth or that they think they have found. So there's all of that. But what really got me about the about your son's trial was his defense attorney. Amazing.
Yeah.
Totally
yeah.
incompetent, but not incompetent. One of the I read he was a famous Chicago defense attorney, and then you paid him a whole lot of money. It must have been very difficult to you and your husband defend Matt. So
Matt's father paid him $50,000, and he told Matt that if he had more money, he could defend him better. And also, he refused to go over to MCC to talk with Matt. He was only over there one time before the trial. He refused to go over there because he didn't like the conditions over there. And I was told that by his associate, the guy that also was involved.
So MCC is where Matt was being held?
Yes.
What's that?
MCC?
What's that stand for?
Yeah. Metropolitan MCC Correctional Center in Chicago.
Okay.
And
Chicago,
he's in the conditions there. Go ahead.
And I was just going to say, okay, Chicago Correctional Metropolitan Correctional Center. Matt was being held during his trial, and this attorney that
I'm sorry, hon. He was. They moved the trial to Hammond, Indiana.
Oh, so, I see. Not during his trial. While
right.
he's preparing for the trial.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And his attorney did not defend him, and my opinion of that, and I've said this before, is that his attorney had a big trial coming up. He was unhappy. He was only getting $50,000 to defend Matt. He and his wife were in the process of buying a new home, and his daughter was going to be married in 2 weeks. So, my opinion is he wanted to get it over with. And that's what he did. And so he was supposed to call witnesses. And then, of course, the real thing there is that Matt asked him, he told him, I want to testify. And his attorney, Thomas Durkin, told him, well, I'm not prepared to do that. And so Matt was not even allowed to testify because of his attorney.
Well, what kind of background did Thomas Durkin have? I just I got the impression that he was very well-known in Chicago, very highly established.
He was in the past, but I feel like that he was, you know, he wasn't winning any cases anymore. Let's put it that way. And I noticed him. I noticed, okay, in his office he has lots of drawings and paintings of him on all over his walls, okay? And so I noticed him during the trial. He was sitting back in his chair, allowing this artist to draw his profile. And,
oh my.
And instead of being concerned about what was going to happen to Matt, that's what he was doing, sitting there and posing for a drawing.
Well, you know, while Matt knew that he wouldn't come and talk to him in the correctional center, and he didn't want to let him testify, although he may have learned that toward the end and too late. But you were watching this. First question is who picked this attorney out, and second is. Why did you continue going on with him, knowing that he wasn't doing a good job?
We didn't know he wasn't going to do a good job until the trial. The reason that he was picked was that someone in MCC told Matt about him, and that's Matt just is sort of like drawing a straw. And so yeah, and so he selected Thomas Durkin. We
now,
went
at
to
this
see
point,
him.
Yeah, Thomas Durkin went to see Matt.
No, we went.
Oh, you went to see him. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Matt's father and I went to Chicago on a Sunday to talk to Mr. Durkin, and he gave him $50,000. Well, after he gave him $50,000, you know, we thought he was going to defend Matt. Of course, at the time, he said, they have no case. No worry, you know, no worry. Yeah, right. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter that they had no, and they didn't have any case, but it doesn't matter because if there's prejudice and the trial is tainted, and then the jury foreman is a man full of hate for Matt and fear, what's the end result going to be? You know.
Well, I was going to ask. I had thought. Well, maybe this attorney Durkin was in cahoots or something, you know, with the FBI.
Yes,
but you're making out that he was just didn't want to take the time. He didn't think he was getting paid enough or something.
He didn't think he was getting paid enough. That's right. And he had another big trial coming up.
Yeah. Right. So
and he made
statements like that did indicate that he didn't have time for it, that he didn't want to waste any time for it.
Yes, and then the terrible things he said to the jury about Matt.
Yeah, we'll get into that. That's another thing. So, I mean, it was really, he was like Matt's worst enemy, actually, because he was the only person there who was defending him. And did you sit through all the days of the trial?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and your husband, too?
Yes.
Now, I'll ask this one question I had starting out, and then we can get back to these other things. I read that your husband was an East Peoria police officer, and in an article in the Chicago Tribune, they said that Hale had never had serious trouble with the law until adulthood. Now, so what was your husband's beliefs about politics and race and so on? And
I'll be perfectly honest, he was what I called a quiet racist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let me say this, please. Every race are racist, okay? If you ask an African-American what race he is for, he's going to be for his race. If you ask a Mexican what race they're for, he's going to be for Mexicans. It is normal, it is natural, and there is nothing wrong with being a white loyalist. There is absolutely nothing wrong with being that.
Yeah, and you always feel that way? I mean, it probably didn't even come up as an issue, but most white people feel that way in those days. You know, I grew up around the same time, I think you did, similar to that, and I actually, Evelyn, grew up not far from where you live in East Peoria, and I'm familiar with Peoria, Illinois, and not so familiar with East Peoria. And I, of course, it was a long time ago I was in Peoria, but I know that it's more the working class area.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so your husband would have been dealing with those kind of people on the in East Peoria. And naturally, I mean, but was there a lot of talk about race or any of that in your home? And I'm not being blaming anything. I'm just asking if there was.
Right. No, there wasn't. And as far as my children are concerned, I always believed that they should be allowed to grow up and believe whatever they wanted to believe. I did not think if there was. A racist in the house, then I did not feel like they should be broadcasting it. I feel like everybody is entitled to their own belief. Okay, that's how I feel about that.
Yeah.
But
well,
I am saying that all racists...
It didn't need to be talked about a lot. It was just a general consensus that we were basically a white society. Still, although there are a lot more blacks in Peoria, and I don't know about East Peoria, maybe that was mostly white working class there than where I grew up. But anyway, so you know, that was the attitude. And Matt has written that he, of course, he's an extremely bright person, and he got interested in National Socialism or something similar to that at the age of 12, and he went ahead and read Mein Kampf. And
he did a lot of reading. He did a lot of reading.
I bet he did.
He did.
Yeah. And you didn't stop him. I did a lot of reading, too, growing up, and nobody stopped me from reading what I wanted to read.
I always taught my children as they were growing up that everybody has a right to their opinion. And if they had something to say to me, if they had an opinion, that I was willing to listen to it. And so, therefore, you know, many times they say, wow, you know, I think about that. But I did. I allowed them to say what they thought.
And
I didn't see anything wrong with that.
Was Matt unusual amongst your children? Or were they all kind of similar? Or was he different? How many brothers and sisters did he have?
Three brothers.
Okay. Wow. That's a great family. Four boys, huh?
Mm-hmm. So, well, I have two children by a first marriage, but
okay.
With that family, it was four.
Okay. Did he stand out in, you know, or?
I didn't think so, other than being in the books all the time and reading. He's very intelligent. I think his IQ is 132. And, you know, in other words, he had a thirsty mind, and the more he read, the more he learned, the more he wanted to know. And so he read a lot, and he still does. I don't know how, and every once in a while he sends home a bunch of books because he doesn't have room for them. But yes, he's still reading, and he definitely believes the way he always did. He is entitled to that. I don't see it. And Matt is a very moral person. He's very clean. I mean, he never drank alcohol. He never smoked a cigarette in his life. He's a very decent human being. He happens to believe in the white race. He thinks he is a white loyalist, and that's the way it's going to stay. It's not going to change.
He's also very committed to his beliefs. He lives up to them, which a lot of people are able to do, and I admire that. But now, obviously, some things happened that were in retrospect unfortunate, but none of it added up to what this trial and verdict states. So none of it even came close to that. But let me just point out here, you mentioned the lie detector test, that I was working on reading the press releases and so on that you sent me, and I really got interested in every one of them because he's such a good writer. And as I started out the show with, when he says something, it's very powerful. And I think it's because of what I just said, that he's very convinced about it himself. And when you truly believe something yourself, then you can pass it on to others. You can make an impression on others about it. And that's what they're afraid of, people who can do that. And he said, writing about the lie detector test, "I'm ready to take a lie detector test, successfully brought about by any reputable media organization at the earliest opportunity. I will field any and all questions. Ask me point blank. Did I try to get Tony Evola to murder Judge Lefkoe? The test will vividly show that the answer is a resounding no. I have lived in solitary confinement and suffered for 10 years for a crime I did not commit. Not only am I not disgraced," he puts that in quotes, "as the Chicago Tribune once put it, but the disgrace belongs to the hideously corrupt legal system that refuses to release those it knows to be innocent. The problem is not that the federal government thinks I am guilty, but rather that it knows I am innocent. The government doesn't like anyone that speaks the truth about justice system corruption, and this is why the courts have refused to acknowledge my innocence, have ignored the facts and the law, and have upheld my convictions that they know are phony. The last thing the federal government wants is for the public to know that it regularly targets and victimizes innocent people, and so it pretends that we are guilty regardless of the truth." Well, I don't know. Maybe if you aren't sympathetic to his beliefs, you might not be moved by that. But I think it's very impressive and convincing statement, and that's just one of the many that he's made.
Yes.
So somebody, they never gave him a lie detector test. Too bad he didn't tell his attorney he wanted to have one.
He did.
Okay. Okay.
It
so now here
be,
we have,
be.
Yeah, because I wanted to bring out that by the time he was arrested, he was already a lawyer. He had finished law school. He had passed the bar exam, the Illinois bar. They just wouldn't allow him to be a member of the bar, but because of his beliefs. But he had passed it. So he knew a lot about law at that point, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So
and he has become a very good lawyer, because he's been forced to become a very good lawyer in being locked in a cell 24 hours a day all these years, and trying to find a way to fight his, for his freedom. I mean, that's what he's done, and he won't stop, and I'm so proud of him. He has done amazingly well, considering what has happened to him. He stays strong. He exercises in his cell. I mean, he plays his violin in his head. That was another thing, of course. He asked for his violin, and I wrote the warden a letter and asked to bring his violin. Of course, that was refused also. But that, you know, he won't ever give up. He will not give up, and
well,
I'm so proud
yes,
of him.
He seems to be using his law degree now in the work that he's doing and the efforts he's making to bring this his case to the attention of people and to the public too, he's doing a very effective job of that. He's always got all the cases numbers and everything that shows that this is legal or illegal or whatever, and they're doing his one of the main things he's complaining about now is that the way he's being treated in this maximum security isolation cell of his is illegal. It's just plain illegal, mm-hmm. even for somebody yeah. like him, and he has all kinds of rights that they're not allowing him. And this is something that really should be brought to the attention of the people. Of course, he's filed
a lawsuit, and like I told him, you know, they just will find a way. They know that he will win that if there's a honest person in the courtroom. But I think they'll postpone it. They'll put it off and put it off because he is right, and it's legally. The legalities of it are for him. I mean, everything is for him. So you know, he can win that one, and he should win that one, but I'm saying that they find a way to just put off doing something, you know, so or
they
allowing
do
him to get into the courtroom.
They do find a way. And that's yeah. why it's so easy to just resign yourself and say, well, there's nothing to be done. But that again, is why, well, what else has he got to do but to work on this and keep his hopes up or something up. So
that's
good.
Right.
But what about this Creativity Church? Is there a large enough membership that is supportive and helps him? I know there would be some people who do, but is there much to that?
Well, I receive donations, and some of them I just receive money wrapped in a piece of paper in an envelope with no return. Because people they want to support him, but they are afraid that somebody's going to come after them. And so, yeah, we do have, I have a list of supporters I send out information to, and I ask for donations, and right now I've been typing his book, and that, by the way, has been very informative for me. I've learned a lot in typing his book, but that's going to be, you know, published, and we ask for donations for publishing his book, and donations because every time he files something, and he will continue, he will not let it go. Every time he files something, it's $400. And so, and so I'm constantly, and I hate doing that. It's just that I know what he needs, and the food isn't really good there. So we have to keep money in his commissary so that he has decent food to eat.
You know, I was reading today that he had written in this long thing, I didn't get to read all of it, his official complaint is a recent one. It's very long and detailed. And he mentions in there that the creativity diet is like nuts or seeds and stuff.
Well, they call them raw foodists.
It's basically a raw food diet. And I thought, I wonder how many people follow that. That's very tough. And I wonder if he can get that in prison.
Well, he's supposed to. He's legally
supposed to be allowed
to have his religious diet. He's also supposed to be able to practice his religion. One of the guards there told him, as long as you're here, you will not practice that religion. You know, so Yeah, he's supposed to have his religious diet. He's supposed to be able to, through mail, he's supposed to be able to give sermons to his followers, to his people. And they've stopped, you know, they don't want him to do that. So, yeah, that's part of that lawsuit, civil suit that
right.
he has going.
Is this what the book is about? I heard you mention another show, something about habeas corpus, that he was going to use the habeas corpus argument.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. But in the book is about how we got to where we are, talking about our founding fathers and what they wanted for us. And it's just very, very detailed and very informative.
Oh, I see. It's not about his lawsuit.
It's not about his stay. It's not about his stay there.
Oh, I see. Well, I was
it's
so
about,
for that.
It's about.
We have
to, go ahead.
Well, for that we have to go somewhere else. There's this press release he put out. But what about there's the website Free Matt Hale. Is this stuff being? Can people find this on that website? I looked at it, but I didn't read all the articles.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I go there every once in a while. I'm not sure what they have on there, but I know that I do send. They do get all the information, just as the rest of the supporters do.
Right. That he would be sending it to them, and that would be the best place to. I could go there right now and look at that. But well, Free Matt Hale. What is the URL for that? Do you happen to know? I'll just type this in.
It's freemathale.com.
Freemathale.com, yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah, it says subscribe to our newsletter. So I did link to this in the program announcement. So, but there's not, unless you subscribe to the newsletter, otherwise, there's a nice message from Matt there, but there's here legal documents, timeline of events regarding the life of Matt Hale. But for that, you have to subscribe to the newsletter. That's what it looks like.
From what I understood, I understood that they were no longer sending those out. I don't know. I'm too busy doing the stuff that I'm doing. I really don't know.
Yeah, right. Well, it would be. And now the other thing before we get to his youth is it would be nice to talk to Matt himself. And I heard you say, and then I read him saying that he had the right, supposedly legally, to give interviews, but that a person recently tried to interview him, a journalist, and somehow. It didn't happen, or he wasn't allowed.
Larry Yellen of Fox News in Chicago, and they refused when he contacted the prison, attempted to set up an interview. They refused. They on the basis of security risk. Okay, and then
so
I
he
said
was
that he
was
going
to go into the prison. This journalist was going to go
he
into
wanted
the
to,
prison.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, what about
and, but also,
calling
what
him
I'm
on
saying,
the phone?
What I'm saying is that he could have phone. Interviews, and I am sure that they would refuse that, and probably have already refused to allow that to happen too. But he isn't legally; he is entitled to interviews, and they have gone into other.
How do they do this? They have he has all these legal rights, and he's not allowed them
because
he doesn't have an advocacy on his side, and if he doesn't have an advocacy that amounts to enough. Nobody knows about it, and they can just
do what they want to do.
Yeah, right.
That's what they do.
Yeah,
but there have been other prisoners that have been allowed to have interviews, and so they won't let him have interviews. That's the way it looks. And I suggested to another person that I was speaking with. Her name is Left. Yeah,
Deanna.
And I suggest to her that she attempt to have a phone interview with Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
The matter of calling
the
prison and speaking, asking to who his counselor is and asking to speak with the counselor. The problem is that every time I've called the counselor, I leave a message and he never returns my calls. Okay? So whether or not they could make contact, or somebody could make contact to the warden's office and ask for an interview, whatever it takes. I mean, he is legally, he can have an interview, and somebody, you know, if they keep trying, maybe somebody would finally be able to interview him. But that would be really good, because I know everything about the trial, but that talking to him would be something different, and that would be wonderful.
All right. I think it would be probably very impressive. So,
yes.
Let's just take a second here, a minute here, to talk about his cell. I heard you say that on Deanna's show that when he goes out, when he's allowed to go outdoors, he has to be in a cage.
Yes.
And he's not allowed to walk in the yard, like, you know, where they have these
prison
right. yards where people walk around. And I suppose he has to be out there all by himself, nobody around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
And his cell is, what does he have in his cell? I just read today that he does have TV. He can watch TV. He said
he has TV.
He
has, I think he gets, he can listen to his classical music. You know, he's a violinist. He loves classical music. I think he does that. And he does have a shower in his cell. Somebody mentioned that he was only allowed to have showers once or twice a week. That really isn't true. He has a shower in his cell. I'm sure that his cell is full of books, and I send him things all the time. He tells me he calls me his figlet, he calls himself his figlet. And so when I write to him, I see dear figlet, and because he loves figs, okay, and figs are one of his natural foods that he loves to eat. And so, but I'm sure he has pictures of different drawings and things that I send him that he has on his walls in his cell.
Right, but
and
he's not allowed to see anybody, so therefore he would have his own bathroom in his cell and so on, because they don't want him to go out at all.
Right. And when they, I don't know if I sent you anything on that, but when I visited him, it was really sad because they had leg irons on his legs, and he mentioned to me that any prisoner goes down to the visiting room, they have to have leg irons, and they bleed. And he was telling me his ankles were bleeding, and that upset me. And I sent a letter to the warden, and I said, if you have to have leg irons on these people, I consider it a form of cruelty. And if you have to have leg irons on them, put them in a wheelchair and wheel them down to the visiting area. Because I think that is totally uncalled for. That is so, there's so much security there. There is no risk. It's sad. It's really sad that they do that to these people.
Yeah, I think it's a part of punishment, like not allowing him to have his violin. I thought about that. I thought that's so cruel. Why shouldn't he be able to do that? But they want to make sure that he's getting the punishment he supposedly deserves for somehow wanting to kill somebody, which he didn't want to do anyway.
And he's on a unit. He's on a unit where everybody there except him has killed somebody. Poor Matt. I mean, Matt should never be there. I mean, of course, he's innocent.
Well, he's 100%. He's a political prisoner. So, let me go through some of these things, because it's kind of interesting, and people might find it interesting, although actually it comes from Wikipedia. So I want to know if it's true or not. Wikipedia got almost everything on their page about Matt Hale from Southern Poverty Law Center. And the Southern Poverty Law Center played a big role in the trial and in the whole thing, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah. They were right in there, and the ADL has a lot to say about it, too, but mainly Southern Poverty Law Center. And they say that in August 1989, he entered Bradley University. He studied political science, and in September 89, just the next month, he began writing editorials in the college newspaper, the Bradley Scout, and in doing so, he espoused his views of white separatism. So are you aware of that? Are they exaggerating this a little bit or what? He probably would.
I don't know.
Refer to it
I don't
to some
know.
Degree, maybe. He was a smart guy. He was writing editorials already as a new freshman in the college. Okay, well, then He got into a debate with another student, and I couldn't tell if the student agreed with him or disagreed. They probably disagreed. And they talked about the Ku Klux Klan, and this student brought it up. And so then in the spring of 1990, after the winter semester, the spring semester of that same year, actually, freshman year, he invited the Ku Klux Klan to the campus. And then that same year, I don't know when, they don't say, maybe later, he was expelled from Bradley.
Hmm.
And do you know, I bet you don't even remember him being expelled.
No.
I'm not sure he was, because later on he was still there. So, and they don't say how he was reinstated. So I have my doubts whether he actually was expelled.
Not that I know of. I think I would have heard that. Not that I know of.
Yeah. Well, then at the age of 19, well, he entered when he was 18, normal age, college age. And the following year, I guess he burned an Israeli flag at a demonstration, and he was found guilty of violating an East Peoria ordinance against open burning. Now, this might not have been at the university.
That wasn't.
Okay, yeah, because
the
university is not
Beacon.
In East Peoria. Okay.
No. It's in Peoria.
Okay.
I believe the burning of the flag was in Pekin, Illinois, I believe.
Okay, so there was a demonstration, and he being a go-getter, and right out front there, he burned this Israeli flag. Not such a bad thing to do, but they got him on open, you can't burn things. They have an ordinance against open burning. So did that amount to much?
Not that I know of. It was a misdemeanor as far as I know.
Yeah, sure. Then the next year would have been 1991, maybe. He supposedly, according to them, he passed out racist pamphlets, which might have been creativity pamphlets, which they would consider racist, I don't know, to patrons at a shopping mall and was fined for littering.
Okay.
All right.
And it was creativity stuff, yeah.
Okay, so he was into being a creator, and he was passing out creativity pamphlets. But so they call it racist pamphlets and make out like he was, bothering people. Then in May 1991, Hale and his brother allegedly, I'm emphasizing, but they have that word in there, allegedly, so how much can you put in that? Threatened three, probably came from the Southern Poverty Law Center. See, well, it did, all this did. There's a whole paragraph there, and at the bottom it gives it's from the Southern Poverty Law Center, so it gives a note reference to it. They allegedly threatened three African Americans with a gun, and Matt was arrested for mob action. Then, since he refused to tell the police where his brother was, he was also charged with felony obstruction of justice. And he was convicted of obstruction, but he won a reversal on appeal. So, do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that. There were three of them, and they came at him with a bat, and his brother David got a gun out of the trunk of the car and threatened them. That's true.
All right. Well, see, it's good to hear the real story.
He was saving his brother. They came at him with a bat.
Yeah.
So... that's what happened there.
All right. And that's probably why he got it reversed on appeal, because, when they convicted him, it was just another one of those things where they trying to do you in. So, all right. Now, here's something, true or false. In 1992, Hale attacked a security guard at a mall and was charged with criminal trespass. Resisting arrest, aggravated battery, carrying a concealed weapon.
I know what happened there.
Yeah.
He was at the mall. He was passing out his religious papers, and a security guard took him down in a corridor where there wasn't anybody. He beat the hell out of Matt. That's what happened there. Yeah.
And he was resisting being beaten. So he was resisting this security guard.
Of course. Of course.
Yeah. And here's where they put it here, and then they say he was sentenced to 30 months probation and 6 months house arrest. But then where this came from, there's no, it's not, it says these, this last sentence was not in the citation that's given for it. So
as far as I know, he had no house arrest.
Okay. See, this is where you have to be so careful. And on Wikipedia, they don't care if people add junk that they don't
right.
have any proof for, and they will at least say, you know, they will at least add that it's not in the citation. But a lot of people just ignore that, those things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Matt is actually not a violent person at all.
No, I didn't.
And I worry about him. I'm actually glad he's in solitary confinement, because if he weren't,
that's right.
they'd kill him.
I think so. I think it's probably better for him. But it's a long time. He seems to miss having a human company.
Oh,
you know?
Yes. I long to hug him, you know. When I went to visit him, of course, it was through glass. And it was very difficult. It was very difficult.
Oh.
I also got a really bad burn on my hand, by the way. Because they have you, they stamp you, and then you have to reach up to this light, and they didn't tell me, watch out, you might get burned. I got a really, really bad burn on my hand. It took a month to heal. But anyhow, they were aware of that, so their nurse's office or whatever came down and looked at it, and they said, we'll treat that for you. And they went away, and they came back, and they said, we were told we cannot treat it, but we will allow you to leave the premise, and then after you've had treatment, we'll let you come back in for the visit. And I said no. So when I got home, I sent the warden a letter, and I let him know about it. And you know what he did? He sent me a letter back, and he said, "We treated you for that." No, they didn't.
They're so horrible. Yeah.
They're covering their butt, you know. But they did not. They would not treat me, and they were told they couldn't treat me. And so then the warden said they did treat me. They didn't.
Yeah.
So, but they didn't want to get sued. Anyway, I told them they should recess that light because I really had a bad burn. And of course,
that'd have been a super hot light, and then not having
any
treatment, and visiting your son, and then not doing, being able to do anything. You have to take care of
burns
right
away. I was in very bad pain.
Yeah.
It took all three layers of skin, let's put it that way. It was a long time healing.
You know what? It's really good to have you here saying these things. People, you know, you have to hear these things, and you have to hear Matt or read what he writes and talk about these things to really get the feeling and to get angry enough about what's going on. And no matter what you think about Matt himself, this is a terrible injustice, and something should be done about it, because a lot of people get in trouble and they do stupid things, you know. But so far, I haven't found anything that he's done that is stupid, particularly in getting your feedback on it, and that he, you know, somehow, you know, brought trouble on himself. I don't think so. So let's go on here.
I wanted him to be quiet. I was worried. And I'd tell him, They're going to stop you, Matt. They're going to stop you. And he'd say, as long as I follow the law, I don't have to worry, and I will follow the law. That was what he was all about, is the following the law. That's why he wanted to become an attorney and try to change the law and the justice system. So, you know, but he would never pay attention to me because he believed, you know, he believed what he believed, and he wasn't going to change his mind.
Yeah,
and
I
so,
read
and
that
he believed
said,
he should say it.
That he said that he thought that this Evola, well, let's just jump into that right now. This Tony Evola, who was the informant.
Evola, Evola, hon.
Okay, Evola. He said that he knew he was an infiltrator for 2 years, but he didn't worry about it because he knew he was never going to break the law.
And he liked him being there, because he was a strong presence. He was a big guy, and he would stand on stages when Matt would do speaking engagements. He would stand on stage beside Matt, protecting him. That's what he wanted people to believe, that Tony Evola, you know, was his bodyguard, so to speak, and he was going to protect him if anybody wanted to do anything bad to Matt. And so he liked it. I mean, and he thought he was harmless. I mean, he was like I said, he was mentally challenged, and he knew he wasn't going to do anything wrong. And this guy, you know, I mean, it, 2 years he taped him, and he never once said, kill anybody. And so then they go to the court, and he testifies, and so that's what they, the FBI, or the, you know, that's what the prosecutor wanted him to do. And so they ask him, did he ever tell you that he wanted you to kill Judge Lefko? And Tony said, well, I asked him, and he nodded.
Yeah, that's totally impermissible. That's like,
isn't that awful?
That's just hearsay. I mean, even if he said, yeah, I asked him and he said yes, that's still hearsay. Doesn't he have to have something more, like something on tape or whatever?
That's right.
Well,
and there was nothing on tape.
He was wearing the tape. Yeah, okay. So he was wearing a tape, and they hear him asking these questions and talking like this. What other things would have been on the tape? I mean, was there a lot of racist conversation or jokes about
talking about it, talking about his speaking engagements and where he was going to go next and things like that. I mean, I'm sure there was racist talk. I mean,
sure.
If you want to call it that, I mean, talking about what Matt believes in and supposedly what this Tony believed in. From what I understand, Tony was doing maintenance work, I think maybe cleaning up a school or something, and he had some misdemeanor charge against him or something, and that's how they got a hold of him, and they paid him $75,000 tax money to do what he did. So
yeah, well, there's a lot but Matt felt that I was thinking maybe Matt felt that if he got rid of Evola, who he knew and didn't think was too harm, you know, was kind of harmless, even if he was working for the FBI, that they'd just send somebody else. You know, I mean, you can't get away from that.
He wasn't worried about him because, number one, he knew he was never going to do anything against the law. He always said, and he told in on the tape several times, he told Tony, I won't have any part of anything like that. And I've told you before that I want to make legal change. And so he told him many times, no, he's not interested in anything like that.
But the one time that he didn't say anything, and then Tony says, well, he nodded. How they get the jury to believe that? Well, there you've got that jury foreman again. That you told us about. I mean, the whole thing is just such a travesty.
And he wasn't there for selecting the full jury. He was only there 48% of the time,
right.
You see, and that time that he wasn't there is when his attorney wasn't doing his job, and he allowed, I don't know how many African Americans were on the jury.
I was going to ask you that. What was the makeup of the
that.
Jury? Okay, do you remember how many African Americans there were?
I believe three. And then there was this jury foreman who was homosexual. He allowed him through. He passed him as a juror. And see, if Matt had been in there and saw what was going on,
well, Matt should
then
have
it would have
objected
been a different
to
thing.
That. Couldn't, you know, Matt should, in fact, that's, some of these things are enough for a retrial even. I don't know the law, but he knows the law.
Well, I think at least
a retrial. He should have objected with his attorney that he told him he didn't need to be there. He was too passive, it seems like.
Well,
but I know how that can
him.
Happen. Go ahead.
You know what his attorney told him? Somebody has to be, how did he say it, the captain of this ship, is what he said.
Oh,
somebody
boy.
Has to be the captain of this ship, yeah. So he made the decisions. And poor Matt, I mean, he was, I'm sure, in shock. He probably couldn't believe any of it. I know I couldn't. I think my head didn't fall off because I'm sure it was shaking back and forth. Unbelievable what was going on. I could not believe that trial. I could not believe that the prosecutor could tell the jury the last thing in his closing statement. He told the jury, the government had evidence that Matthew ordered one of his followers to go out and kill and injure many people. And his attorney didn't object. The judge didn't say disallow that statement. Nothing. Nothing went on. It was terrible.
The SPLC has written, I saw this somewhere on the internet. I mean, I saw this on somewhere else, but I wasn't at the SPLC site, but I've got it here that it's from the SPLC. And they wrote, but the worst blow of all came when Hale was arrested in January 2003 and charged with soliciting the murder of a federal judge who had ruled against him and his group in a trademark infringement complaint. A Pacific Northwest church with anti-racist views had copyrighted the World Church of the Creator name years before and was demanding that Hale's group stop using it. Okay, this was a lawsuit he had going because
May I say something?
Yes, please.
Okay. The trademark case. Matthew was working on an appeal. First of all, let me say this. He did not dislike Judge Lefko. He liked her. She ruled in favor of Matt the first time around, and then a higher court ordered her to reverse the decision. Matthew had worked 2 weeks on an appeal to go before her that day that he was arrested at the courthouse. That's where he was going. And I know that he had worked on the appeal because he called me and discussed it with me and what he had in it and everything. And so that's why he was there. So he was not angry with her. Why in the world, why would he want her killed in the first place? He liked her. He didn't blame her because she voted or ruled in his favor, and a higher court ordered her to reverse her decision. So why would none of it makes any sense. None of it makes any sense.
And no, this is how the SPLC twists everything around.
Yeah.
So there was this copyright issue about the name of the church. That's
yes.
all.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, you
yes.
know. And
Matt he was going to tell the judge that day when he went back there to appeal that decision. He was going to say, tell her that he had already made plans to put a cover on top of the books, you know, glue another cover on there that had changed the name, which is what the other church wanted him to do, or wanted him to not
right.
use that name. So he was ready
yeah,
to go.
Yeah, they wanted him to destroy all those books with their name on the cover, with World
mm-hmm.
Church
and
of the Creator
to,
on the cover. And he didn't want to destroy all those books. Okay.
Yeah.
All
so
right.
he was going to
well,
ask if that would be acceptable, you know, if he could just glue on a new cover.
And then they arrested him when he went
yeah.
to the courthouse for that, whatever. And they arrested
yeah.
him on this other thing, and he never was
yeah.
free again. Never
nope.
again. Well, the SPLC goes on after that to say, with this sentence, which I don't understand at all, said the following year, Hale was convicted of four felonies and sentenced, oh, four felonies. I was thinking of murdering four people. Oh, four felonies and sentenced to 40 years in prison. What were the four felonies then?
Oh, gee.
You know?
I don't know.
Okay.
One of them was another witness that the prosecutor had up there was, I can't even remember his name now, this is terrible, but he testified that Matt had wanted him to kill somebody previously. But this man was not believable, and they dropped that one. They dropped
right.
that one. He eventually did kill himself, that guy.
Well,
I can't
see, it just shows
his name.
how they were getting all these stories together
yeah.
to use.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
if they needed them. Yeah. All right. Well, then the one thing that was, but it couldn't have affected the trial, was the fact that after where is this story about Birdsong? In 1999 already, after he had passed his bar exam, and then the state bar wouldn't allow him, give him the right to practice in Illinois. 2 days later, this Creator member and college student, Benjamin Smith, resigned from the church and went on a three-day shooting spree. And he shot at a lot of racial minority people, and including 9 Orthodox Jews. But he only two died, and that was a black basketball coach in Evanston and a Korean graduate student in Indiana.
Yeah.
By the way,
Ricky Birdsong. Okay.
Uh-huh.
He worked at the university with the jury foreman. Okay. The jury foreman.
Oh.
Yes, he worked with him at the Northwestern University.
Oh, yeah. Gosh. So the jury foreman knew that he would have been, that Birdsong was killed and who he was killed by and so on. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a, you shouldn't have that connection either.
Right. That's why I said the judge should not have brought in another man's crimes, because Matt had this kid that did that crime had ended his membership with the church. In fact, I saw that he had wrote him Matt, and he said, and in this he said, I can no longer follow the law. And that's why he quit. He could no longer do what Matt had told him he had to do, because all the members had to agree to do no violence and nothing against the law. And so he was not going to do it anymore. And I saw the letter that he sent Matt leaving the church.
Well, the way it's put, it comes across as that Matt was in some way, responsible for all these young members who are going out and doing crazy things because of the teachings.
And he wasn't. And there were other times that he ousted people that were violent. And he said, that he preached that all the time, no violence, nothing against the law. And he always said, we will make legal change. And that's what he meant. So he had, and he was shocked when that was done, and they chose to bring that in. I didn't think the judge should have. I thought the judge and the prosecutor. Well, he had, when they first went in the courtroom, he mentioned to the prosecutor that he had been in his courtroom before. So probably not only that, but they probably had coffee together too. And Matt's attorney he mentioned
that.
Well,
they do that, They're all very chummy.
Sure.
Back in the back rooms there.
They're
all part of the, the defense attorney and the prosecuting attorney and the judge and everything, they all get along just fine back
there.
Oh,
I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, then Matt did say, he's quoted as saying, and he appeared on, he got a lot of attention from this. What this Benjamin Smith did, and he was trying to use that. And when you're in the kind of a cause that he was in, it's often said that there's no bad publicity. All publicity is good publicity if it brings attention to you, and it brought a lot of attention to Matt and the creativity movement and the racial idea of white racialism. So he was no doubt trying to make. Going along with it and giving all these interviews, and he's quoted as saying that we do urge hatred. If you love something, you must be willing to hate that which threatens it. Well, I'm sure he said that because there's no reason not to say that.
Right.
I agree with that myself, but they make a lot out of that because they've made hate into a crime. And even more so now than it was then. But
Better put a lot of people in jail than they better get on that one.
You're right, but they have so that they use that as he was just bad, somebody who should be taken out of society. So he's where he belongs. He should be there and so on. It's very hard to go against all this. Only other thing I have here is something from if you want to say anything about Glenn Greenwald, who was his lawyer when did Glenn Greenwald, who's pretty well known, start being Matt's lawyer?
I don't know how long he was Matt's attorney. I know that Matt called him with questions about the trademark case and how he should handle it and this kind of thing. So Glenn Greenwald was one of the witnesses on the list, one that didn't get called. Greenwald actually at one time donated to Matt's church. He believed in a lot of things that Matt believed in, and so he did donate at one time. I know that for sure. But he called him and he was supposed to testify, and his testimony would have been good. for Matt, except that he wasn't called, like none of the rest of them, over 100 witnesses waiting to be called.
Yeah, no, now here's called. The last thing here, that that supposedly this his own defense attorney rested the case. He didn't even put on a case.
No.
Is that how do you do that?
Well, he just didn't think that he, I my opinion is he didn't want to take the time. He really didn't do anything.
I guess his argument was, well, the government has not proven its case, so we don't need to make a case.
And by the way, Matt has had recent contact with Thomas Durkin, and Thomas Durkin has admitted that he didn't understand the case, and Matt asked him to sign an affidavit, which would help Matt get a new trial. And Thomas Durkin has refused to do that up to this point. But he's actually had telephone conversations with Thomas Durkin. He feels bad about what happened to Matt, but he thinks his reputation is on the line. But he admits that he didn't understand the case, and he didn't understand the case. He didn't even work to practice or to study for the case. Ah. So no wonder he didn't understand the case.
Well, I wonder if Matt, in his complaints, you know, trying to get something redone here, can't he use all the failings of this defense attorney of his?
I believe he has. I believe in some of the appeals and whatever he has. He charged it with ineffective assistance of counsel, and they denied that appeal. I mean, and if anybody's guilty of ineffective assistance of counsel, it's Thomas Durkin, because he didn't do anything to defend Matt. Yeah. He also told the jury what a terrible person Matt is.
Well, let me.
And he should be charged. He should be found guilty on morals.
Durkin said that? No, the prosecutor.
Oh yeah, Durkin told the jury that Matt should be found guilty on morals.
Oh.
Yes.
But not on that crime.
But on morals. Yeah.
Well, that's a stupid thing to say. Horrible.
I know.
Just horrible.
Well, I saw an attorney on television talking. He said that if you don't like your client, no one else will. And
well,
so you don't go before the jury and tell them what a terrible person your client is.
Well, he wasn't even a terrible person. He was just a white advocate.
Yeah.
Racially.
That's right.
Okay, but
that's
terrible.
Right.
Well, let me invite callers right now. We'll stay on for five more minutes or so, Evelyn, and see if anybody calls in. If there's someone out there who in listening land there who would like to talk to you and has a question for you, for Evelyn, please call 323-642-1206. 323-642-1206. I have something here from Tom Metzger. He's been a big supporter of Matt Hale.
Yes, he has.
Years,
he's been
obviously.
Very sweet. Yes.
Yeah. He says a lot of strong things, but nothing that we haven't already said. He does say here that directly upon the state resting its case, Hale's attorney, noted Chicago criminal defense lawyer and former federal prosecutor, he was a former federal prosecutor too, Thomas Durkin, rose and rested Hale's defense without calling a single witness or introducing a single shred of evidence. Durkin reportedly made numerous remarks derogatory to his own client throughout the trial. Both during the state's case and during the closing argument. What kind of closing argument did the prosecutor make? Was there anything outstanding about that?
What he said was, all I remember is the last thing he said in his closing argument is that the government had evidence that Matthew ordered one of his followers to go out and kill and injure many people. That's what he said. That's the only thing that really hit home with me. I thought, you know, when I heard it, and the judge didn't say anything. Matt's attorney didn't object. It was terrible.
I would have stood up. It would be hard not to stand up yourself and say, I object.
I wanted to.
and say, hey, Durkin, get up and object
Wake
to
up.
This. My gosh.
I know.
Well, it's an amazing, horrible situation. I don't know. It's worse than I ever thought. You know, I'd known, as I say, I'd known about Matt Hale, and I knew that he was all, it was always said that he was railroaded, but they say that about everybody, but they can railroad you, but to do the ineffective defense that he had is what gets me, and it wasn't even, I think he would have done, you would have done better with the jury appointed or whatever, what do they call that, court appointed attorney, than with this guy.
Well, I think so too. Could have saved some money and had just as good of a defense.
Right, it couldn't. It would have to be almost had to be better. Anybody doing a decent job than what this guy did.
For sure.
And then he says he feels bad. I'd have it in for him. I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
I'd really have it in for him. Well, you are very peaceful people. Not having done, had worse reaction to all this than you have. So, it's quite. Let's close off here. If we don't get a call here. You're wanting and needing, you really need contributions. I'm going to send your contribution.
Yes, I appreciate it.
And the book that's going to be coming out, and say again, I will put it in the post, but not everybody looks at those. So say again your email address. No, it wouldn't, that's not where it would go. But the people can write to you at Evelyn Hutchison, 1938. At gmail.com, right?
Yes.
And people can donate by sending to your to a mailing address you have?
Yes, Evelyn Hutchison, 200 Carlson Avenue, apartment 25H, Washington, Illinois, 61571.
Okay. All right, very good. And I think after hearing you, people shouldn't be worried about their money not going to the what they sent it for, or if they don't want to be known who they are, it will get there. Sometimes people are afraid money gets lost in the mail. The mail is hardly ever lost. And people want to send something in an envelope without their name on a return address on it, and just
however
wrap
they want
it up
to
in
do
paper
it, money
or
order, check, or cash.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that it all goes to Matt.
Right.
It all goes to Matt and to publish his book.
Yeah. Right. When do you think the book will be out?
I've typed everything, but the very last part of it, and I sent it to him because he wanted to make any corrections or changes or whatever, and then he will send me the final. Chapter, and I will type that, and then it will go to the publisher.
Okay. And so we've got that to look forward to. And people can buy the book, and that will help with the fundraising, too.
Yes.
I take it. So, all right. Well, good for Matt. He's doing everything he can possibly do. And by doing things, it does help keep keep his spirits up to some degree every day. If he wasn't doing anything,
yes, it does.
He resigned.
And he has people,
himself.
You know, he has supporters that write to him, too, which help him.
Right.
Help him
right.
with
it
his
helps,
attitude.
Right. Helps him to get mail. And what is his mailing address?
His mailing address is Matthew F. Hale, and behind that is his number, 15177-424, USP. AdMax, and then it's Florence, Colorado, 81226.
Is it AdMax is capital
I'm
A?
I'm sorry,
capital...
post off, I'm sorry, after, it's okay, it's, I'm sorry, Matthew F. Hale, 15177-424, USP AdMax, box, post office box, 8500, Florence, Colorado, 81226.
Okay, post office box what?
81226. Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
Post office box 8500. 8500. Post office box 8500.
Okay. Florence,
Colorado.
Colorado.
81226.
Six. Okay. Well, I would really hope some people will write. Of course, if it's just pointless mail, you wouldn't necessarily help them. But if you really have interest in this, I'm sure it would. Be nice to write to them, and they do like to get mail, and prisoners like to get mail.
Yeah.
But how is that AD? USPAD Max. How is that?
Oh, AdMax. ADMAX.
Okay, is that all caps or just ADM is caps?
A. Just the A.
It's caps, and then D.
MAX.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right, just like a word. All right. USP. USP? Did you say that?
Yeah. USP, okay. AdMax.
Okay, all right. I'll get that. We'll get, hope people should have it by now. All right, well, Evelyn, I want to thank you very much. You're a great guest, and this has been very interesting for me. Certainly, I have a better understanding of than I did have just from what I've read. So keep it up and keep your end of the deal up there. You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, now here's a phone call from somebody. Gosh darn it. I didn't see this when I already hung up by all of a sudden somebody called. Hello there.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
What's your name?
Don from California.
Oh, hi, Don. Well,
hey,
I'm sorry. I was just saying goodbye to Evelyn when your phone call popped up. I didn't really notice it. What did you want to ask?
Well, the very, very ineffective defense by her lawyer, I don't know if the guy was Jewish or not. I'm not sure that would have made a whole lot of difference. But
I don't think so.
I don't think they would have gotten
a Jewish lawyer.
Well, I think based on what I heard her say about the trial and the fact that he put on no defense, I'm not surprised that a conviction resulted from that. That's about mm-hmm. what you would expect. And of course, all of the denigrating remarks and the cracks about trying to bring in other unrelated matters and trying to smear the white activist defendant. White people as a group kind of suffer from a pathology of cowardice and timidity in today's world, and that cowardice and timidity exist among white lawyers as well. I was involved in one case where I represented a white defendant who has been charged along with 35 or 40 other white defendants and their families and their distant relatives based on an assault against a black person at some teenage party out in the desert. Now, he wasn't killed. I guess they cut him with a knife or something or threw him on the ground, and that's really not important. But the interesting thing to me that I noted is a lot of the white defendants were completely innocent. They weren't even there. My guy had moved out of the state a year and a half before the event even happened. He hadn't lived in California for almost 2 years, was anywhere near it. And the same was the case with a number of other of these kids who got sued. And one thing I noticed about the lawyers is the white lawyers, whether they were the only lawyers involved, the plaintiff's lawyers were two well-known Jewish, quote-unquote, civil rights lawyers from out in San Bernardino County. And one thing I noticed is the complete lack of any moral authority or any moral courage. It was like they were always apologetic, always coming in from a defensive posture. I had a dead-bang alibi defense on my case. I mean, my guy was living in another part of the country, 1,000 miles away, and he had payroll checks and stubs and utility bills and rent checks. And, he could prove his whereabouts for more than a year before this incident even occurred. So, but I noticed others who had alibi defenses as well, almost as good as mine. I mean, there was this sense of defeatism, this sense of moral inferiority or something. It was very strange to me. And I was as rude to them as I could possibly be. I mean, it got to the point where they cringed when I walked into a room because they were getting none of this belly-crawling crap from me. And I noticed that these Jews, I mean, everybody thinks they're Superman or something, mm-hmm. and that they're invincible mm-hmm. and they can't be beaten. Well, they can be beaten, and they have been beaten. I got my guy out of that on a summary judgment motion. We didn't even have to go to trial. And unfortunately, a number of the defendants had hired some law firm to handle the thing. And these guys, I think, were totally incompetent. They let the case go to trial. And there was a, you know, several hundred thousand dollar jury verdict awarded against several white defendants and their families. But it was not because of Jewish invincibility or the system. It was because the lawyers didn't want to fight. And,
well, you know, let me just.
And I never understood that, because I fought like hell. I got my guy out on a summary judgment motion, and that's discretionary with the judge. I mean, it's not the judge certainly wasn't, you know, prejudiced against my guy. And most judges are not that prejudiced. They don't care. They see a lot of weird stuff. They deal with a lot of weird off the wall people. But you know, like your guest said, if your lawyer doesn't like you, don't expect anybody else to. And if you throw your client under the bus. And you're defeatist, everybody's going to smell it. They're going to smell the blood in the water. So you have to show some guts, you know?
I thought that maybe this lawyer, as I said, that their lawyer was in cahoots, and he had been, you know, they had gotten to him and, you know, said, come on, we don't want this guy to get to go free. We want to get him. We need to get him. And he went along with them because it's so extreme. But you're saying that... you agree, but she didn't seem to think that was it. She said, "Well, maybe, you know," but she did believe
who
it.
Knows
he
if
just didn't want to bother.
Or not. I mean,
and it seems as though
may very well have been collusive. Although former prosecutors are generally pretty good defense lawyers, but you know, if the guy did nothing and he denigrated his own client, you know, that should have been reversed on the grounds of lack of effectiveness. Counsel, but if he's lost on that, then he's already lost.
Well, she said that he told Matt during one of the few times he talked with him, visited with him, that if he had more money, he could do a better job.
Well, that's always
actually
true.
Told his client that, and
of course, Matt had no more money,
and probably didn't want to ask his parents for more money because they didn't have any more. So. What does that mean? I mean, what kind of a thing is that to say to your client? He just seems like he was a real jerk.
I mean, you have a duty to tell your client if you need more money, because it's the client's decision whether to spend the money or borrow the money or raise the money. There's really nothing wrong with that. That's
so
generally
he didn't
the
make
case.
A case.
Yeah, if you have more money, you can do a better job.
So Donnie
but
didn't
you have
make
a duty.
A case.
What?
Wait a minute. He didn't make a case because he didn't have enough money to spend on. Going around and investigating or getting paid.
Well, if he didn't make objections in the courtroom, that has nothing to do with money. And
that's
if he
right.
didn't call witnesses, that has nothing to do with money.
Well,
and if he made disparaging remarks about his own client in the courtroom, that certainly has nothing to do with money.
Well,
that has
Evelyn
to do with
said,
either abandoning your client or behaving like a coward.
Well, we already said that. Evelyn said that he was... that he didn't, that they had a whole list of witnesses. Who put this list of witnesses together? That he didn't call
them
on.
Well, I assume that,
They had a bunch of people lined up that were going to testify.
Well, you don't necessarily call all the witnesses. You need, many are cumulative. Sometimes their testimony is not admissible, but because they don't have personal knowledge of things. But the point is, if he didn't call any witnesses, and he basically made an argument that supported his own client's conviction, it would be hard to expect any other outcome of a trial. And my point in calling was that, you know, white cowardice and white timidity exists in every part of white life, including white professionals. And I think this, you know, the sense, I mean, he understands that if he fights like hell, that's going to be held against him professionally in that community. My experience has been just the opposite. If you fight like hell and get a good job, however despicable the client may be, you're generally respected in the legal community for doing a good job.
That's what I always thought. Yeah.
I mean, that was...
it's like wins, you know. How many wins have you got versus your losses? Yeah.
Well, I talked to some of these lawyers who, after this case was over, after the trial. You know, my guy got out on a motion for summary judgment. The trial happened about 9 months after that. And I called him after the trial was over to say, you know, what happened. And there was no publicity in the press or anything, so I was interested in knowing how it went, since I had some knowledge of the case. And I thought, frankly, the plaintiff's case was pretty bad, except for there were three or four who were convicted criminally of the attack, so, you know, that pretty much seals their doom, even in the civil case, because that controls the outcome of that issue. But there were people who had dead-bang alibi defenses. There were, you know, distant family members, the parents. I mean, your 18-year-old kid goes out and gets in trouble, and you're liable for that, for what he does when he gets drunk. And they never, there was no pretrial preparation done. It was just sloppy, crappy work. And, you know, you see a lot of that. I mean, there's nothing conspiratorial about that. You see enough of that in non-controversial cases. But one thing I noticed is even people had the insurance companies defending them, where money is not the object. The insurance company funds the defense. And even if there's no coverage for the claim, they get a defense. And even the insurance lawyers were gutless, belly-crawling pieces of crap. And I crossed paths with one of them who I had known about 20 years before. We both worked for another insurance defense firm. I said, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, fight these people. You know, don't give me this racist crap. I mean, your client deserves a defense. And it's like, well, you know, we bill our hours and we get paid. And that's, you know, essentially what we do there. And I had a different view on it. Of course, I had a passionate desire to win for my client, so I got a different result. But, you know, there's just the thing that I noticed among white professionals is so many of them are so intimidated. They are so morally castrated.
Well, they're lazy
even when
too.
They've got the facts and the law on their side, they just roll over.
Well, then that means they're lazy. They don't think they need to work. It doesn't
no, they're
make
not
any
lazy.
Difference.
They're afraid.
Afraid. Afraid of what are they afraid of?
Being called a racist, of being called a bigot, a hater.
Well, then don't
you know,
take the case
I don't
if you're
care
afraid
if I'm called
of it.
Names. You know, big deal. I care that I win. But it was just, it stunned me in this case so much that so many of the defendants had great defenses and their lawyers just blew it. You know, they could have made the same motion I made for summary judgment to get out of the damn case because, the plaintiff, the black guy, he couldn't identify the people who actually beat on him. He certainly couldn't identify people who weren't there. He was just an idiot. He was just like, you know.
Yeah. Thanks, Don.
But in any event.
Don, I appreciate your calling in. You added quite a bit here.
Well,
thanks a lot for the call. I'm going to go on to a little bit of something else. All right. Bye-bye.
Very good. Bye.
Well, there we go. Well, that was all very interesting. I'm always breaking in, and the other person doesn't want to stop. But anyway, I appreciate what Don had to say there. But I think we heard it. So I'm going to go on in the rest of the time here. And if anybody wants to call in, you're still welcome to call in to comment on the Matt Hale situation. But I thought that along these same lines was the persecution of nationalist and white racialist parties, even if they don't call themselves white racialist party. They're known to be such or to be at least pro-white, and so they are also persecuted. And it I was always wondered about the parties in Germany right after World War II. So I started, I did a little search, and I started with the NPD and moved backward toward what it had been before or what other parties were mentioned and had come from. And the first what you might call, what they like to call something like a neo-Nazi party in Germany post-World War II, was formed in 1949 already, called the Socialist Reich Party. That's the first one that I know of. And the leader was Otto Ernst Remmer, who many people would know of, the hero of the Bender Block arrests assassination attempt of Valkyrie a night of in 1944 after the attempted assassination of Adolf Hitler, and how he managed to stop that Valkyrie what do you call it move to take over the German government, because Hitler was out there in the east in a military headquarters, and Remmer was the one who got in contact with Joseph Goebbels, and by the time they understood one another, he was able to get Hitler on the phone, and Hitler talked to Remmer, and Remmer went out with his battalion or whatever and broke into the Bendler block and took charge there and arrested people, and he stopped the rest of it, the rest of what was supposed to be happening. I can't go into that right now, but his partner in that was named Fritz Doris. Doris, D-O-R-I-S is his last name, but he's an interesting man. He's described as a Volkish author. Well, they all were members of the NSDAP, or I don't know if Remmer was able to be a member, but that was the next party, I guess. They were all followers of Adolf Hitler. And, you know, in the beginning, what's interesting, you see, is that in the beginning there was so much more freedom of these people. They had gotten the ones they thought were necessary for them to get and to arrest and so on. And the rest were had rights, still had rights by 1949. And they were doing, meeting and organizing the way they wanted to. But it was called the SRP, Socialist Reich Party, and it was the first party to be banned by the Federal Constitutional Court. That wasn't until 1952. So from 1949 until 1952, they were operating. And what else do I want? I'm just looking at these. I'm going to be going directly from these various Wikipedia pages because I didn't want to try to copy everything down that I wanted to say. So another man involved in this was Gerhard Kruger, and also someone named Wolf. Where is his name? Boy. And they claimed, their platform was that Chancellor Konrad Adenauer was a United States puppet. Well, he had to be. You know, I mean, I think fairly well of Adenauer. He did the best he could, but he was working within the system, you know. And but anyway, they called him a United States puppet, and that the Karl Dönitz, the Gross Admiral Karl Dönitz, was the last, legitimate president of the German Reich, who was appointed by Adolf Hitler. So they were posing themselves as the followers or the people that came after the Reich, you know, that the Reich still existed. And they denied the existence of the Holocaust. This is what Wikipedia says anyway. They claimed that the USA were the ones who built the gas ovens in the Dachau concentration camp, and that films of the concentration camp were faked. And they advocated a Europe led by a reunited German Reich as a third force against capitalism and communism. They demanded the reannexation of the former eastern territories of Germany and a solution of the Jewish question. This was in 1949. And they concentrated on a vague popular socialism in which the old national socialists rediscovered well-worn slogans, and also on a nationalism whose championship of the Reich and war was a continuation of the Lebensraum ideology. This was written by a critic. But in any case, they were carrying on the National Socialism. And they managed to do it. I don't think and none of these parties had a whole lot of followers, but they managed to do that until 1952, when, and they didn't do so badly in the elections either. It says they gained a second seat in parliament. They gained a deputy in the Bundestag in 1949 election, and then they gained another one 1950. And in 1951, they won 16 seats in the Lower Saxony State Assembly, 11% of the votes. This was in Saxony. See, Saxony, for all the criticism it gets, it was a strong National Socialist state district. And then they got 7.7% of the votes in Bremen. Maybe that's in Saxony, I don't know. But then they were dissolved by the federal government because they were determined to have been against the enemies of the new constitution, which is not a real constitution, but it's called the constitution. And so, now does it say here? No, I'm going to have to go to the next one. Close this page so I don't have too many pages open. Now the next one was the Deutsche Reichsparty, the German Reich Party, which was emerged in the British zone of the Allied occupied Germany after the Second World War. It was known as the DRP. Let's see when they started. It was originally intended as a continuation of the German National People's Party, but it soon attracted a number of former Nazis, and its program changed to a more neo-Nazi stance. It was also known as the Deutsche Conservative Party, and also the party used both names, the Deutsche Conservative Partei and the Reichspartei, which means right, not Reichs, but Rechts, which means the right party. The right party. They won in 1949. See, they're all doing pretty well in 1949. In 1949, they won 5 seats among the deputies. Among those who were elected was Fritz Rossier, alias Dr. Franz Richter, who soon became notorious for his radical positions. Did he change his name? I don't know exactly, but despite this success, they were weakened the same year when the Socialist Reich Party, R-E-I-C-H, was formed, and a number of the members who supported Remmer and Kruger, who from that Socialist Party that I told you about first, went and joined this new Socialist Reich Party, rather than the Rex Party, so which was kind of a conservative party. So two of its deputies, Rossier and Fritz Doris, were lost to this Reich Party, and they all were able to get people in the parliament. I don't know if this is in a state one. Sorry about this. Between 1950 and 1951, the remaining DRP MPs who supported Fritz Rossier sought to merge with these groups in order to form a larger grouping, and they created, well, what I'm talking about, the Deutsche Reichsparty. I don't know what here. Few members, have to move on from that one. The next one we're coming to is the, well, that was what that was about, which I kind of got confused, was the Reichsparty, which then sort of merged into the Reichsparty. So now we have the Deutsche Reichsparty, and it is also known as the German Reich Party, and it was a nationalist political party in West Germany, okay, naturally. It was founded in 1950. from the German Right Party, the Rechtspartei I told you about, and it which had been set up in Lower Saxony and had five members in the first Bundestag. Now, this here's giving me more information about the Rechtspartei, but the party moved towards explicit neo-Nazism in 1952 when the Socialist Reich Party was disbanded and many of the members joined this party. It says that the membership of Hans Ulrich Rudel in 1953 was seen as marking out the party as a new force of neo-Nazism, and he enjoyed close ties to Savitri Devi and Nazi mysticism. See, I don't believe that. Who added that. That comes from Nicholas Goodrich Clark in his book Black Sun, who was pushing all this mysticism stuff, writing about mysticism in Germany, and he says that, I don't think that much of him at all, he says that Rudel, the great Stuka pilot, who was always loyal, let's say, to Adolf Hitler and National Socialism throughout his life, after the war, and he spent quite a number of years in Argentina. Then he came back to Germany around this time, when the situation in Argentina changed, and he no longer had any real employment there, and he came back to Germany and he got involved in German right wing politics, and he's a real hero of mine. But I don't, and Savitri Devi may have been in contact with him and all that stuff, but I don't think he ever went for the mysticism stuff at all. So when you read things like this, you know, you always have to check the source. And you have to know something about the sources to know whether to believe them or not. So, I did remember reading that Socialist Reich Party of Remmers, it says in there that its foundation or something was supported by Hans Rudel. But I guess he wasn't a member, but he was supportive of it. Maybe he wasn't in, when this new Reich Party started, he was a member, says here. And they only averaged around 1% of the national votes in the federal elections of 1953, 1957 and 1961. See, they did manage to elect deputies to the state legislatures, the states, the regional or what you call the provincial, but they never got anybody in the federal legislature, the federal parliament. It says their only major breakthrough came in 1959 in the regional election for Rhineland-Palatinate, where they won 5.1% of the vote and thus were able to send deputies to the assembly. In 1962, this party was still going on. This party took part in an international conference of far-right groups hosted in Venice by Oswald Mosley and signed up as members of his National Party of Europe. The initiative did not take off as Mosley had hoped. However, as few of the member parties, including the DRP, were interested in changing their name to National Party of Europe. You see, he wanted everybody to change the name of their party to the National Party of Europe. I guess they didn't like that idea, and they didn't do it, and so it didn't take off. But one of this party's last acts in 1964, the German Reich Party, was that it sponsored a tour of Germany by the controversial American historian David Hogan. Some people pronounce that Hagen. I don't know, H-O-G-G-A-N. I'm going to call it Hogan, because it's not a German name. But this he's a revisionist historian, very, very well known, did excellent work. Anyway, see, they were very active in trying to keep trying to keep this Nuremberg narrative and Holocaust narrative from taking hold, and you know, fighting that quite a bit, quite hard. And the but because of their lack of national success, the leaders made contact with the other rightist parties, such as the German party, and seeking close ties. It was soon decided that a more formal union with other rightist groups was desirable. They held their final party conference in Bonn in 1964. That was the end of this Reichsparty, which they voted to form a new union of national democratic forces. The party was symbolically, the Reichsparty was symbolically liquidated, with the National Democratic Party of Germany established immediately afterwards. So this was then the birth of the NPD that we know today. In 1964, it has a very excellent ancestry, comes from the best people, and I have some things to say about it that show what a great job they have done and how uncompromising the NPD has remained against all these odds. And so we see that in Germany, in spite of the laws that they had this idea that they were a democracy, and they had to allow political parties, because they certainly allowed all the parties on the left. They had Communist Party, they had then the Green Party took hold, and all these left-wing parties. So they couldn't deny right-wing parties, but they did everything to denounce them, of course. But I'm going to go to this page now. Get rid of this one. I don't know what that is. Okay. Let me just say that I'll just do something simple here because I'm running out of time. But the leaders, party leaders of this national party, starting in 1964, were Friedrich Thielen, 1964 to 67, Adolf von Thaden, or Thaden we would say, T-H-A-D-D-E-N, 67 to 71, Martin Musgung, 71 to 90, he was in there a long time, Gunter Deckert, 91 to 96, his term ended because he was put in prison at that time for his part in, promoting a Holocaust revisionist book and a Holocaust revisionist. So from 96 to 2011, another very long term, Udo Voigt, who people are very familiar with, and he's a familiar face. But in 2011, he stepped down probably, but in any case, Holger Apfel took over. But he didn't last but 2 years, or maybe less than 2 years, until 2013. And today, the head of this party is Udo Pastors, 2013. I looked him up. He's a good-looking man. He's what you just imagine a National Socialist of the best type to look like. Very strong face. He's doing it now. Well, let me, I don't have time to, unless I go over time, but some of the things that they did, I think I can fit this in if I can get to the right place here. They always stood up for race, as Hitler always said that we had to do. And they stood up for Germany. They have called itself the Party of Grandparents and Grandchildren, because the 1960s generation in Germany, known for the leftist student movement, strongly opposes the NPD's policies. So they've got a lost generation in there. And so the people who they can look to are only grandparents and grandchildren, but not that current adult generation. At this time that they were saying this, I don't know what is meant by the 1960s generation. If it means you were born in 1960, or you became an adult in the 1960s, or I'm not sure what that means, but I always feel I'm a part of the 1960s generation. And it was very left-wing. So in 2005, they did a lot of good things before that, but I don't have that here. It's too hard for me to follow. So say in 2005, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution tried to outlaw the NPD. Oh, here we go. Here's something I want to say. Their platform asserts, the NPD's platform asserts that Germany is larger than the present-day Federal Republic and calls for a return of German territory lost after World War II, a foreign policy position abandoned by the German government in 1990. At one point, a map of Germany was shown on the party website, omitting the border that divides Germany from Austria. See, I think that's funny. Another time, they failed to color in the Oder-Neisse line. I think it's pronounced Nessa, but Oder-Neisse line. The border that was established between Germany and Poland in 1990. So, and Germany formally agreed that would be the forever border, forever and ever, never to be changed, was this Oder-Neisse line, and they didn't put it on there. So they are a party that still holds that that's why Gunter Deckert always says the today's smaller Germany. He always calls it that because they don't accept that the present borders of Germany are the forever borders, are the borders that Germany should have either. So I like that about them. And I'm going to go over, ladies and gentlemen, just so I can finish what I've got here. Won't be very much, but I'm going to do it because there's no point in starting talking about something like this and then cutting it off and thinking you can add it. I can add it another time, which won't work out. So I will not be so nervous here. So the NPD's platform asserts that, I already did that one. In 2005, they tried to ban the party, and this is really interesting. The Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution contains the following description about the NPD. The party continues to pursue a people's front of the nationals, consisting of the NPD, DBU, and forces not attached to any party, which is supposed to develop into a base for an encompassing German people's movement. The aggressive agitation of the NPD unabashedly aims toward the abolition of parliamentary democracy and the democratic constitutional state, although the use of violence is currently still officially rejected for tactical reasons. Statements of the NPD document an essential affinity with National Socialism. Its agitation is racist, anti-Semitic, revisionist, and intends to disparage the democratic and lawful order of the Constitution. Then, on January 21st, 2005, during a moment of silence in the Saxon State Assembly in Dresden, to mark the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi Auschwitz extermination camp. See what they do? They call it Nazi Auschwitz extermination camp. 12 members of the NPD walked out in protest. The NPD stated that they were upset that a moment of silence was being held for those who died in the Auschwitz camp and that none was being given for those who died during the bombing of Dresden in World War II, with the anniversary of both events falling relatively close to each other. Right, one in January and one in February 12th and 13th, so early part of February. Holger Apfel, who was at that time leader of the NPD in Saxony and deputy leader of the party nationwide, made a speech in the Saxon State Parliament in which he called the Allied forces of the United States and the United Kingdom, quote, mass murderers, unquote, because of their role in the bombing. His colleague, Jürgen Gansel, went on to describe the bombing itself as a holocaust of bombs. Well, then Udo Voigt, the president, voiced his support and reiterated the statement, which some controversially claimed was a violation of the German law, which forbids Holocaust denial. However, after judicial review, it was decided that Udo Voigt's description of the 1945 bombing of Dresden as a Holocaust, because, you see, Voigt was the president, the head of the NPD, so they'd have to get him for doing something very wrong. And he upheld the description of the bombing of Dresden as a Holocaust. And they said that, and the court found that it was an exercise in free speech and a defamation, and not a defamation of the dead was not the purpose of his statement. So you see, they still have to have some semblance of democracy there in these findings, that, you know, people can't just be railroaded unless you're actually making denying the Holocaust, it seems, or saying something about Jews, that he wasn't doing that. Anyway, then it goes on that the good things that the NPD has done during the World Cup. The party's website stated that due to the prevalence of people of non-German descent on the German national football team, the team was not really German. And in 2006, a little later, the party designed leaflets which said, white, not just the color of a jersey, for a true national team. That's what the leaflet said. And this leaflet was... it was never mass distributed, however, but the police came and raided the NPD headquarters and confiscated the copies of that leaflet, and authorities were hoping to find material linking the party to Nazism, and this black soccer player on the German team was later informed that the poster showed the image depicted of a footballer wearing a white jersey with his number on it. He is 01 Patrick Owomoyela, a Nigerian of Nigerian descent, and he had been on the German national team the year before. And so he filed a lawsuit against the party, this Nigerian football player. And the party was able to delay the procedures, but in April 2009, three party officials, Udo Voigt, Frank Schwert, and Klaus Bieber, were sentenced for Volksverhetzen and to 7 months and 10 months on probation, though. They got probation. But they still had the sentence on their record for that little leaflet that said, that showed white is not just the color of a jersey. I don't know if he was in there, but his number was on there. In November 2008, shortly after the 2008 United States presidential election, which elected, as you recall, Barack Obama, this is a good one, the NPD published a document entitled Africa Conquers the White House, which stated that the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president of the United States was the result of the American Alliance of Jews and Negroes, and that Obama aimed to destroy the United States white identity. The NPD claimed this, they said on this document, A non-white America is a declaration of war on all people who believe in organically grown social order based on language and culture, history and heritage, to be the essence of humanity. So it's a declaration of war on an organically grown society. And then they also wrote, Barack Obama hides this declaration of war behind his pushy sunshine smile. And then they stated that the extensive support for Obama in Germany, quote, resembles an African tropical disease. That's going pretty far because, and you know, Obama was super popular in Germany, always was, these simple-minded Germans. They seem to have this thing for black people. Anyway. So then in September 2009, another incident involving the NPD and a football player of the German national team, more on the football, was reported. An NPD spokesman named Bayer called midfielder Mesut Ozil a Plastideutscher, or plastic German, which is taken, you are to take that as an ID card German, someone who is not born German but becomes German by naturalization, particularly for certain benefits. So they've got an ID card that says they're German, and that's the Germans have this phrase, Plastideutscher. Pretty good. That's pretty good. In 2009, April, the party was fined €2.5 million for filing incorrect financial statements, resulting, according to Deutsche Welle, in serious financial trouble for its administration. Well, that's a huge fine, to fine them €2.5 million. There was a lot behind that because there was something wrong with their financial statement. That was a huge blow, and I don't think they got out of having to pay that either. Anyway, in 2011, I better go back now to the to my blog talk page. I don't see any calls right now. In 2011, authorities were reportedly trying to link the party and specifically 30-year-old national organization director Patrick Wischke to the so-called Zwicken terrorist cell. You know, that's that National Socialist Underground baloney. This raised the possibility of another effort to outlaw the party. The likelihood of success of renewed banning attempts has been questioned, given, they haven't done it yet, but given the Office for the Protection of the Constitution has over 130 informants in the party, some in high positions, raising the question of whether the party is effectively controlled by the government. Now, this is important. I was going to make a point of this, that everywhere, every FBI-type organization, every state security organization has informants in every party and in every organization and every group that exists that they think might be, you know, not 100% for them, but not. They probably even have them in the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. And I'll bet, when I think about this, I think I'm sure that amongst the Republican and Democratic parties, the Republicans have informants in the Democratic Party and vice versa. Why wouldn't they? Of course they would get people to go and join that party and try to get, you know, become. They always want them to move up to one of the top jobs, you know, so they can have inside information. So every one of our groups, every one of people's websites, people who are commenting on websites, are filled with fakes and Jews and other kind of people who are there to do cause trouble. And every organization has got infiltrators in them. And for the most part, they say there's nothing you can do about it, so they just don't worry about it as long as they're not breaking the law. And these people get paid, but they don't often. The thing is, they're supposed to come up with some interesting information for the people that pay them. In this case, it's the Office for the Protection of the Constitution in Germany. And so sometimes they make things up or exaggerate so that they have something to tell us. They just always say, no, I don't. There's nothing interesting going on here. They're not going to keep being paid. So that there again, you can have a lot of misinformation being passed on about your organization. But I mean, it's a fact, and I don't think we spend enough time thinking about it, or we're not as aware of it as we should be, and let so many things go by. And we have assassinations, like we have all kinds of things because of this infiltration problem, because of these enemies from breaking in. What's that called? The Trojan horse thing. I don't think there's enough attention put on that. What happens is that people just start attacking their people they don't like, and that doesn't help anything either. Well, I could stop here on this theme, or I could. I've got this little story here, but I don't really have time for it, so I'm going to let it go. So that's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. It's a persecution, and it's the those who are working against us who get in, even if it's like with poor Matt Hale and his lawyer, who turns out to be someone who's not going to work for him at all. And if his lawyer is not working for him at all, what kind of a chance has he got? So this is my message for today, and I want to thank very much Evelyn Hutchison for everything that she contributed, and I wish her all the best in her efforts, and also thank Don for calling in. And so I'm going to say goodbye now for Saturday afternoon with Carolyn on this September 20th, 2014. See you next time.